You seem to have an animal theme going today. So, I actually have a confession to make to you this morning. I am one of those cat ladies. Yes, I am. It's true. I just love cats. I love everything about them. I will happily tell you stories about all the cats I've had in my life and all the cats I've loved. And if you were to ask my family or my husband, you would find out that this is not a new development. I have loved cats since I was a little tiny girl. And it always surprises me to learn that not everyone shares my love. I want everyone to share this joy. And so it was with great delight that I came across a blog post by Janet Perriott a few years ago that was entitled, Cat Adoption in 12 Easy Steps. So Perriott wrote about how at one time her family had 6 cats, and that the last one of their beloved cats, Pooter, had died. And so they were suffering the tragedy of petlessness. She was thinking about adopting another cat, romantically remembering how loving and playful her cats had been. So in this process, her husband suggested a 12-step program to help her remember the joys and challenges of cat ownership. So step one of this 12-step process is called the cat in the lap. And it reads like this. Every time I sit down, I must pick up and hold in my lap a plush-covered, heated bowling ball, randomly studded with spikes, containing one extremely stinky spot. The plush covering must shed, and the spikes must be sharp enough to draw blood. I must jab myself with the spikes occasionally, enough to puncture my skin and create pulls and pills in my pants. Every half hour, I must reposition the bowling ball on my lap, ensuring that the stinky spot comes within 1/2 inch of my nose. As a cat owner, this sounds about right. There are 11 more steps in this process for a cat adoption, exploring all of the joys of cat ownership. And those of us who are cat people, we love them anyway, stinky spots and all. As I reflect on my love of cats, stinky spots and all, I realize that this is true of people, too. We all have stinky spots. Those dark places we'd rather not notice, those things we've done that we wish we could take back. And yet, with luck, there are people who love us anyway, stinky spots and all. The first of our 7 Unitarian Universalist principles says, we covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Because we see our principles as open for discussion and interpretation, there is a movement in our denomination to change the wording of this principle to the inherent worth and dignity of all beings. This change comes out of our animal ministries, which call us to recognize that we are one of many beings that inhabit the earth. I like this change because it would encompass my beloved felines, as well as bring us in line with our 7th principle about the connection, the interconnected web of existence. The Fellowship Sal Espana is involved in this movement, and he will have information and a petition available after the service, so please be sure to see Sal for information on the First Principle project. But even if we limit this principle to people, it is still a strong statement. Many religious traditions begin with the belief that humans are flawed, born in sin, in need of salvation. This belief was what the early Unitarians and Universalists railed against. William Ellery Channing, a 19th century Unitarian minister, believed that there is a spark of divinity in each of us, and that the human spirit can be perfected. This optimistic view of humanity is the hallmark of our religious tradition and is also reflected in our third principle. We affirm and promote acceptance of one another and the spiritual growth in our congregations. We believe that the work of our congregation is to accept each other and to support each other as we grow and change. This radical acceptance is more than just tolerating each other. It grows out of our first principle. Acceptance comes from the recognition of each person's inherent worth and dignity, each person's spark of divinity. The spiritual practice of these principles is our great gift to each other and to the world, and it is our great challenge. One of the gifts that UUs bring to the world is that our principles call to us to action for justice for all people, especially those who are seen as less than, because we recognize their inherent worth and dignity. The spiritual practice of these principles is also a great challenge. In writing on the first principle, Unitarian minister Kenneth Collier put it this way: "It does not say the inherent worth and dignity of people with whom we happen to agree or whom we like. It does not say the inherent worth and dignity of like-minded people or people who are willing to enter into rational, civilized discourse with us. It does not say people with whom we may disagree but who are honorable and as genuine in their beliefs as we are in ours. We are also called to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of people whom we thoroughly dislike. People whom we find obnoxious, obstreperous, overbearing, and frightening. People whom we find abhorrent and whose beliefs and behavior we find disgusting. Even people who would deny, silence, or destroy us." In short, Collier says, we recognize the inherent worth and dignity of everyone, no exceptions. We all have our particular challenges in this regard. I can come up with a list of people who I would find hard to see as worthy, and this may be especially easy in the midst of an election season. You each would have your own list, I would imagine. This principle doesn't ask us to agree with the behavior or the beliefs of everyone. It asks us to recognize their inherent worth and dignity despite the fact that we might disagree with their beliefs or behavior. It requires that we separate being from behavior. It asks us to see everyone as human and treat them as worthy despite what we may label as their stinky spots. So it is our spiritual practice to live these principles. One of the ways I find most helpful is the spiritual practice of the Buddhist tradition called the Metta Meditation or Loving Kindness Meditation. The purpose of this practice is to open our hearts and develop compassion for all beings. It consists of reciting specific phrases that bestow blessings upon ourselves and others. The meditation begins by saying phrases like these: may I be happy. May I be well. May I be safe. May I be peaceful and at ease. It moves out into the world wishing blessings upon others. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be peaceful and at ease. It continues repeating these phrases as we call up images of our loved ones, then friends, neighbors, acquaintances, and finally, those that we might have difficulty with. High on the list that I would have difficulty with would be those who neglect or abuse animals. Recently, I had the opportunity to use this meditation in a situation you won't be surprised to learn involved a cat. I take a daily walk in my neighborhood, And I have a couple routes that maximize my neighborhood cat contact. It's a good walk when I can pet several of the neighborhood cats. And about a year ago, I noticed a very skinny orange cat with no tail and a very deformed ear. She came right up to me and crawled into my arms, settling in to be petted, and oh, how she purred. I made a point to walk by her house, regularly getting to know her. I noticed that she lived on the porch at this particular house, and I could tell that she was fed sometimes by the presence of a large pile of empty cat food cans. Each time I left her was harder, and each time I'd say a blessing. May you be well, may you be safe, may you be peaceful and at ease. It got to where I would go and sit on the porch steps and hold her for a while, and then I began to brush her to try to keep her as free of fleas as I could. And eventually I met her owners. I learned that her name was Olivia and that she was 13 or 14 years old. She had been the cat of a family member, and when that family member died, this family had taken her in. They were allergic to cats, and so they kept her on the porch, keeping her outside and taking care of her as best they knew how. She'd lost her tail as a kitten when she got trapped in the engine of a car, and I learned that her ear was deformed because she'd gotten ear mites so badly that her ear was infected and turned in on itself. I noticed that she was often hungry, and so I got their permission to feed her extra food. And I would also leave some cans of food on their porch because they told me sometimes they would run out and hadn't been able to feed her. I got their permission to put a cat bed in the back of the porch out of the rain. And as the days got warmer, I brought a bowl and water and would refresh the water every time I came by. When they went away for a weekend, they would ask me to feed Olivia because normally they would leave her to her own devices. So last spring, her people asked me if I didn't just want to adopt Olivia. You saw that one coming. So after learning that she hadn't been to the vet for several years, I suggested that I take her in before making a final decision. So I took her for an exam and blood work, and I brought her home, putting her in a room of her own to keep her away from my cat, Simon. She settled into our guest room quite nicely, enjoying a warm, safe place to sleep with regular food and water. Within 2 days, I learned that she tested positive for feline immunodeficiency virus, FIV, which is the feline form of AIDS. This explained her frailty and her continual hunger, as well as the painful sores in her mouth that made eating hard. She was fairly advanced with this fatal and incurable disease, and she was highly contagious. Cats spread FIV by fighting. It's in their saliva, and they spread it when they bite each other. There was no way I could put her outside again. I had no idea how many cats she had infected in the times that she had had FIV. And I couldn't continue to keep her in my house with the risk that my cat would also get FIV. The rest of her life, however long it was, would be filled with infection and illness, and eventually one of those infections would kill her. And so I decided that euthanasia was the best route for her, and so I stopped by to let her owners know of that decision. I was with Olivia when she died. I grieved her suffering, and I grieved her passing. For several weeks, I couldn't walk by that house. I was in one of my dark places as my grief and sadness turned to anger. How could they have not noticed how she was suffering? How could they have let her be so ill and infect other cats? Why didn't they take better care of her? How could they let her suffer? I had a hard time reminding myself that these were not bad people. They had certainly done some things I didn't like, and they were not bad people. Eventually, I began to walk by that house again. Even now, as I walk by, I still sometimes get a little weepy and a little bit angry. And as I walk by, I try to remember with gratitude that I knew Olivia, that she no longer suffers, and that no more cats will be infected. That for some last months of her life, she was cared for and in love, and that the last couple of days of her life, she received a lot of love. So now as I walk by, I also offer her people a blessing. May you be well, may you be safe, may you be peaceful and at ease. And as I do so, my heart softens and opens up just a little bit more each time. This meditation reminds me that we begin by blessing ourselves, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of all persons, acceptance and growth is also true for each one of us. We are called to see our own worth and dignity, as well as that of others. We are called to accept ourselves and practice compassion as we learn and grow, stinky spots and all. I remind myself that I too am worthy of blessing. May I be well. May I be safe. May I be peaceful and at ease. Writer and researcher Brené Brown began studying connection between people and ended up studying shame and vulnerability. In her book, Daring Greatly, she reminds us that we all have dark and light within us. What she found is that we are loved for our vulnerabilities, not despite them. Her research showed that the only difference between people who feel a sense of deep belonging and those who don't is that they believe that they are worthy of love and belonging. Let me say that again. The only difference between people who feel a deep sense of belonging and those who don't is simply that they believe that they are worthy of love and belonging. People who feel connected have developed practices that enable them to hold on to their sense of worthiness despite internal and external messages to the contrary. They believe they are worthy of love and connection, stinky spots and all. This fellowship is at a critical time of growth and change, moving from a small family-sized church to a larger pastoral-sized church. And more people means, well, more stinky spots. And change can mean more chances to disagree. Or we can look at it as perhaps growth and change, meaning more opportunities to practice our first principle. May we all grow into a place where we have a confession to make to each other, where we admit that we are all one of those people, one of those wacky Unitarian Universalists who say, come, come, whoever you are, who believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all beings, and who practice radical acceptance of ourselves and of others, stinky spots and all. I'll give the last word to Brené Brown. Only when we are brave enough to explore the darkness will we discover the infinite power of our light. May it be so. I invite you now into a few minutes of meditation, reflection, and prayer. And now I would invite any comments or questions you might have.
I had an interesting experience yesterday. I stopped at the library here in Mac, and when I came out, I discovered a little note on my windshield, and it was from whoever I had parked next to, and it said, "How could you park your car so close to mine? I could not possibly get into mine." Obviously, he had, because he left, but it was difficult for him, and he said, "You don't know how to drive your car properly." Well, I still have an. I wish I brought it with me. I would have read it to you because it was much more eloquent than mine. But he was perfectly civil, and he just said he hoped that I would learn how to drive a little bit better, and signed himself the man who could not had a hard time getting into his car. And I looked to see, and I was over the line next to his car. So there's my stinky spot, and I'm feeling quite guilty and ashamed of myself. So I'm going to be ultra, ultra careful about parking. Do you think, I wondered if you thought that I should try to answer it, but I don't know how to get, was my note left by any of you?
You know, there are times when it seems like our tradition of giving up confession maybe wasn't the best idea. There are times when confession might be really handy.
I agree. I just wanted to say how much I appreciated the note that you have and the insert in our order of service, and that came in terms of talking about the Republicans and Democrats in the election time. Because as many of you know, I have a father who's a wonderful politician and is a Republican, and I am highly offended when people make derogatory comments about Republicans, regardless of what affiliation I am, because he's a wonderful man who's done wonderful things, and I take it really personally. So while that might be a stinky spot for me, I greatly appreciate the words that you said. Thank you.
Thank you. It always surprises folks in the UU 101, you know, when we talk about there's 6 to 8% of UUs who are Republican, and some folks kind of go, huh? There's nothing that's incompatible there. And so I really do invite you, when you encounter someone who says, if they're brave enough to admit in UU coffee hour that they wrote a book, to chat with them about it, because it'll be a fascinating conversation, I can guarantee you that. And I tell you, there are several members in the Salem congregation who are Republican, and I know that because I've had conversations with them. And when I'm writing a sermon or a welcome or something, I keep them in mind as I am writing, because it's for everyone, right, including them. And so I'm really grateful to what they have taught me about what it really means to be welcoming.
I think the idea of seeing the spark of the divine and the light, the worth of every person, is something that we can adapt. Reacting to the behavior of those divine sparked people can be really challenging. And so maybe just a couple of thoughts about how you transfer that mental heart knowledge into your actions with others.
Mm-hmm. You bet. You know, the reaction, we all have our buttons, right? So abuse a cat and man, my button is pushed like in a half a second, or any animal. And so really, I think part of it is our own self-knowledge about where our buttons are, and we might learn about new ones all the time, and then knowing that they're going to be pushed, because they are. And quite honestly, that's one of the things about family dynamics and friendships sometimes, is the folks who love us also know where our buttons are, and they can be really good at pushing them, which is what makes relationship interesting. So it's knowing yourself, it's knowing that your buttons are going to be pushed, and when they are, having a strategy for what you're going to do. And for me, it's stopping. As much as possible, as much as I can, to simply stop. And, kind of tamp down the dinosaur brain that's saying, you need to fight with them. And take a breath and figure out what's happening and how I've been pushed and really what's going on. Because usually the reaction is a lot more about me than it is about them. Like in the story that I told, this family was doing the best they could. It's not how I want cats to be cared for, and they were doing the best they could. So there you have it. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I think the knowing and then the stopping is probably the biggest, because once you can kind of get the dinosaur brain calmed down, then you can actually make a heart connection with that other person and have a dialogue about what's happened and how it's affected you. Thank you. Thanks.
So this brings up nonviolent communication, and what we're taught in there is that when we are triggered, that the first person we have to give empathy to is ourselves. And so even though that dinosaur brain is doing what it's doing, the first thing to do when we stop in NVC, as we're taught, is to acknowledge that, oh my God, I'm feeling really upset right now. You know, to acknowledge that to ourselves first, and maybe embrace ourselves or give ourselves empathy in whatever way that we do first. Because when we're filled up and we're at peace and at ease, only then can we really extend ourselves outward.
Back here. Thank you, Patricia Fay.
To follow up, on February 28th, I'm going to have a simplified service on that very topic and the 8 things that block good listening communication, and it's all about our reaction from inside. So you'll learn some techniques as to what's really going on in there. And I think it's simple enough that you'll remember.
Hi, to play devil's advocate for a moment, I come not frequently because I'm busy, but my mom's here some. I've been in a lot of other UU congregations intermittently, toe in the water. And one of the reasons is that I think that the problem that the UU has that's most significant for me isn't about not accepting people that are Republicans or conservative. It's about not accepting people who aren't nice. If you're a person who is more aggressive or in your face, a lot of us that are sort of radical leftists in the activist community don't feel very welcome because people don't think we're nice. So you might want to think about that.
Yes. And it's good to be challenged once in a while. I'll never forget in our first UU church in Eastern Washington, we had a speaker come who essentially challenged us and said, would you be welcoming to someone who spoke from this pulpit from a pro-life stance? And that would be hard. You know, I've been a pro-choice advocate for a really long time, and that was a good challenge. And so, really, how big is our tent? How are we in relationship with folks who maybe we see as not nice?
Would you be welcoming to an anarchist who wanted to violently overthrow the government?
Well, you know, the question was, would we be welcoming to an anarchist who wants to overthrow the government? That's the boundary that I talk a little bit about from the minister this time. Right. There might be behavior that we wouldn't find acceptable, and I would suggest that behavior that leads to violence is not acceptable within UU congregations. So overthrowing the government by violence, maybe not so much. Protesting, asking for change, voting so that we can change, you bet.
So you would make sure you vetted your pro-life candidate to make sure they weren't in shooting positions. That'd be good.
Sure. Any other questions or comments? As always, thank you so much for the dialogue. It's always useful and interesting.